It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, more and more schools in Wisconsin are asking voters in their districts to pay more for school spending. We talked to a researcher about why we're seeing more school referendums coming up. First, we're less than a week away from the midterm elections, and there are some interesting and important congressional races to watch across the country. And immigration has been big news this week, with more than 5,000 active duty U.S. troops being sent to the U.S. border, and with President Trump claiming he could end birthright citizenship by executive order. Our question for you this week is, do you think that the president is right to want to remove the constitutional right to be a U.S. citizen if you were born on U.S. soil? Why or why not? What do you think of the timing of bringing this issue up right before the midterm elections? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Fernando Pizarro is the Washington reporter for Univision. Fernando, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Yes, thank you. I love Central Time. I used to live in Iowa, so I'm used to Central Time.
Wonderful. Well, no jet lag for you then when you talk to us. That's fantastic.
No, not at all.
Well, before we get into the specifics of the troops to the border and this birthright citizenship thing, let's talk about the timing and the politics here. President Trump wants people talking and thinking about immigration issues, it looks like, as we come into Election Day, right?
Oh, absolutely. The timing for the president, in a way, is perfect. There's been much talk about what caused this migrant caravan that started a few weeks ago. And let me tell you, give you some context here. This caravan began in Honduras, the first of three now, because now there are three different groups. Everybody tends to agree that they began sort of by context in social media. They were kind of spurred by some leftist activists in Honduras trying to make their government look bad. Their current president, President Hernandez, is not very popular. So anyway, these people seem to have organized via social media and decided that this was a cheap way to go altogether and not paying coyotes or traffickers to bring them up here and paying enormous fees. However, this caravan began the day after the U.S. and Mexico hosted at the Department of State the presidents of Honduras, Guatemala, and the VP of El Salvador, in which they were going to talk exactly about this. And this caravan begins the day after these meetings end here, after Vice President Pence, DHS Secretary Nielsen, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, they tell them that the message is, look, tell your people not to come here illegally. Anyway, so now we're getting to this point that this, as we all know, that this caravan is getting closer. There's still about 900 miles. That is the one that's closest to the U.S. border. And the president tells the Pentagon to need some authority first, a request from DHS, which was given last week. And on Monday, they announced that instead of sending 800 active service troops, they're going to send 5,200, which is a pretty high number. Now, these are not the National Guard troops that were sent during the spring, during the first caravan, which we all know ended up in the zero tolerance policy, the separation of families crisis. This is a different group. These are active duty service members that are going to be sent, but pretty much with the same type of mission, which is a logistical mission. They are not to be in contact with the migrants. They're there to provide air support, air surveillance, transportation. They are bringing, literally, they have installed 22 miles of, they call it concertina wire, which you may know it's pretty much barbed wire. And they're ready to install another 150 miles of concertina wire along the border. So that is going to be their mission.
And some people are saying, well, this is a theater, this is a political stunt. Some people saying, no, this support mission actually will help with border security. How do we untangle the political argument over the meaning of these troops going there?
Well, today, Defense Secretary Mattis just defended the move and said clearly this is not a political stunt to help in the midterm elections. But it is clear, Vice President Pence just said today as well, that, you know, they're making this a political issue by trying to energize the Republican or the Trump base, who is afraid of this group. And as we know, President Trump has repeatedly called them gang members, and he also mentioned that they've clashed with the Mexican police, which it did happen this weekend, and that he's also beginning to blame Mexico. He's been very careful in how he talks about Mexico now with an incoming Mexican president on the 1st of December. And also, let's remember that now the whole issue of the whole trade agreement has been fixed, and now we're facing a new trade agreement that needs to be ratified by the Congresses in Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. But he's beginning to change his tune on Mexico and blaming the authorities for letting the group go on and basically reach the U.S. border.
Talking to Fernando Pizarro from Univision. He's a Washington reporter there, talking about some of the top stories in national news this week. A lot of those related to elections and immigration issues. The other big immigration story, Fernando, the president saying in an interview just over the last few days, this came out, he would and could, he says, end a so-called birthright citizenship by an executive order. A lot of disagreement on that from constitutional scholars. Let's give a little listen to part of that interview with Axios.
It was always told to me that you needed a constitutional amendment.
Right. Guess what? Amendment.
You don't. Number one, you don't need that. Number two,
I mean, that's in dispute.
You could definitely
that's very much in dispute.
Well, you can definitely do it with an act of Congress, but now they're saying I can do it just with an executive order. Now, how ridiculous. We're the only country in the world where a person comes in, has a baby, and the baby is essentially a citizen of the United States for 85 years with all of those benefits. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And it has to end.
It's been pointed out that about 30 countries have something like that birthright policy. But, Fernando, again, this issue at this time, what do you make of this?
Well, the context of the question, this issue, I don't think it was on anybody's radar right now. This issue was prompted by the question from our colleagues from Axios that you know, had this exclusive with the president. And then he seems to talk a lot and tends to give some statements that end up not being true, like, which is what you just mentioned about there are 30-something countries that do have birthright citizenship, most of them in the Americas. It is said that many of these countries were giving people those rights because they were, back in the past, they were attracting immigrants, and I mean countries like Mexico, Canada, and other countries in the Americas, in addition to the U.S. But he does need, that's what most scholars agree on, he does need a constitutional change. He needs a vote in Congress to change the 14th Amendment, which was adopted in Congress in 1868, mostly to grant and to secure citizenship for former slaves after the Civil War. But it was in 1898 that a very important case came before the Supreme Court and basically ratified this birthright citizenship. It is possible to change it. This is not a new idea for Republicans. Republicans have brought this issue back in the past. And now even some Democrats are saying that they would be willing to do that. Senator Joe Donnelly from Indiana, which is in a very tight race, he just mentioned he would be open for some legislation. Apparently Lindsey Graham, Republican senator from South Carolina, said that he would propose something to help President Trump on this issue. But we're really far from this. As you probably have reported on, Speaker Ryan criticized the president on Thursday about this, and then President Trump today came really hard on Speaker Ryan and said he doesn't know anything about citizenship. He should probably instead concentrate on keeping the Republican majority in the House instead of talking about citizenship. So this is a contentious issue. It is easy to understand the anger and concern that people have about these migrant caravans. And let's focus that this would be something that would be affecting the children of mostly undocumented immigrants that would have kids here, and they're, you know, obviously would have the right to U.S. citizenship just by being born in the U.S. But as I said, this is not a new topic. Even President Trump brought it up during the campaign. So he's now using it to rile up the base.
We're talking about some of the big national political stories of the week with Fernando Pizarro, Washington reporter for Univision. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And this idea from President Trump is called "And Birthright Citizenship for People Born on U.S. Soil to Parents Who Are Not Citizens Themselves." What do you think of that idea? Do you believe the president that he has the authority to do that? Or would you need a constitutional amendment? If it's a constitutional amendment, is it worth doing? Call 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our look at some of the top political news out of Washington this week. Fernando Pizarro is with us, Washington reporter for Univision. Taking your calls now on some of the immigration issues out in this week before Election Day. Ben is with us in La Crosse. Ben, hello.
Hi. My comments are this. I think, one, I don't think it's a dichotomy between he's just throwing things out for the election or that he has the authority to do this. I think that we have a president who honed his public voice through reality television. I think many things that we have seen is he will throw out lots of ideas and see how people respond. And my fear is that with this president and the wayward direction that the GOP has gone in allowing him to kind of do whatever he wants, what we're seeing is he's shopping out these ideas that are kind of, in essence, proto-fascist. And just like a television show will kind of tease out plot lines and work with a focus group and see which ending to this movie people like, which direction should this reality show go, I think he does this very purposely, throws a lot of ideas out, and sees how his base will respond and sees how his party will respond.
Ben, thanks for the call. Fernando, what do you think? Trial balloons from the president and whatever sticks, he'll run with it.
Well, that's a very good point that your caller had. We had the opportunity to talk to many people on both sides of the aisle on this issue yesterday. Many of the national Latino organizations were pretty angry about this, and many of the legal scholars say that he does not have the authority. But about the idea of trying things out, one of our Republican analysts said, look, you know, I don't put it past the president or the White House to maybe try and get this idea out there, see how it feels right now in the middle of an election season, and throw out this executive order, which is going to be immediately challenged in the legal courts, and see how far it goes. Right now, they have a conservative Supreme Court, and they're just basically testing the waters to see, or they would if they actually do this, even though the White House did tell us yesterday there were no immediate plans in order to sign this executive order. But let's say it happens. They may be trying to test the waters to see how far they can go in the courts.
Thanks for that call. Go next to Edith in Milwaukee. Edith, hello.
I am calling, and as from my accent you can tell, I am also an immigrant. My parents were political immigrants to this country. While on vacation to Portugal a few years ago with my husband and daughter, we were at a very nice resort and got to talking with an older lady who was holding a baby, and her son and daughter-in-law were in the pool. And she told us that her son came to America to go to school someplace in Southern California, Santa Barbara, I believe she said, and got married so they would have a child, and this child would become an American citizen. And consequently, she said she already considers herself an American citizen, and so do all their family members.
Edith, we don't have too much time. Fernando, that's a concern that critics of birthright citizenship have, that people game the system, they have a kid here in the United States, and that's their way into the country, I guess, is a concern that's often raised.
Well, that is the main concern behind what Republicans and particularly this president has called chain migration, which is basically he wants to, and many Republicans have in the past, again, this, not a lot of these are new ideas, have wanted to change the system to a more what they call a merit-based system to bring in more people that have higher levels of education. And it is true that many people who bring in, you bring in their relatives, but as any immigrant that has gone through the system knows, and many Americans have not, obviously, it is very hard to bring quickly any relative that is not an immediate relative, and I mean parents, spouse, and children. Anybody else in particular, even adult children, it's hard to bring and take some time. However, the whole issue of bringing in people by merit is been suggested in the past. It was tried to they try to include it in some of the past legislative efforts in Congress, and as you know, all of them have eventually failed. But it's not a new idea. The main problem is, again, is for people who have very low skills, like the migrants that are coming up from Honduras, there's very little way for them to come legally. So when the president or the administration said, well, go back and try to apply legally, there's almost no way for such a low-skill worker to come in. There are only very few visas that tend to be very temporary and for very specific jobs, like in the hospitality industry or agricultural industry, which are those meant to be temporary in nature in general.
Thanks for your calls. I promised Fernando we'd talk a little bit about midterm elections. We just have a minute or so left. Where are you watching the most closely right now?
Well, I think there's so many to talk right now, but we basically the bottom line is we know the Democrats need to flip 23 seats. 17 held by GOP tend to be very competitive right now. The Democrats have identified between 100 to 73 competitive races where they need to flip the House. There are about 56 Republican vulnerable seats as well in red states, particularly in the suburbs, that they are hoping to win. Right now, according to many of the experts and the polls, which of course we've learned maybe not to believe until we get some surprises at the end, that there's a higher chance of the Democrats to take over the House. And the Senate side is a little harder. There are many races that we're watching, like the one to replace Jeff Flake in Arizona, or the one that Senator Joe Manchin in West Virginia faces a really hard call. Then there's Texas, Beto O'Rourke against Ted Cruz. Not so far from you in the House, we have the Iowa 1st District. Abby Finkenauer facing the incumbent Republican Rod Blum is one of the hot districts. Of course, let's not forget the open seat for Paul Ryan. Mm-hmm. But I think right now, the way things look, House Leader Pelosi said very confidently just a few hours ago that she thinks that the Democrats are going to win the House. But the polls seem to show that things are tightening a lot, and it's going to be a very close call.
Fernando, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Fernando Pizarro is a Washington reporter for Univision. He joined us for a weekly look at some of the top stories in national news. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher.
You might imagine that a winter weekend trip to visit the ice caves on the Lake Superior shore would be an adventure of fun and discovery. But one never knows what darkness lurks around the next bend. Mia Noel shares this tale at a live storytelling event presented by Exfabula in Milwaukee.
There are some people who really love the outdoors, right? I am not that person. I grew up in cities, first in Chicago and then Milwaukee. I grew up watching horror movies. Black people don't do so well in those movies, right? When I think cabin in the woods, I think Jason is gonna come and like murder you, especially if you've had sex, right? Or like there's Deliverance style hillbillies around the bend of a river. And then as I started to get older, I started to challenge those fears. But that doesn't mean that I'm not scared. It doesn't mean that, right? I still in the back of my head, think that there's probably something out there trying to get me, but I'm just, you know, it's worth it. It's worth that risk. So like 4 years ago, someone posted these pictures of the ice caves at the Apostle Islands, and they were beautiful and they were gorgeous, and it was all this like frozen ice, and there's people with like crampons and they're like hiking out to the ice, and I was like, I am gonna be that person. So as soon as they said like the ice is thick enough to go up out onto the ice along the lake shore and go into these caves, I started planning my trip. I got a bunch of friends together. Then those friends invited other friends, and it turned out we had 8 people. And I didn't know everybody, but I was like, they're friends of friends. We're all going to get together. We're going to look at some ice. We're going to hang out. What bad thing could happen on this trip? So Saturday morning, we wake up really early. We go see the ice caves. We spend the whole day looking at frozen water, right? We're in it. We're taking selfies with ice. It is beautiful, right? There's ice stalactites, and there's ice formations, and we're crawling on the ice, and we got, you know, we're out there. Thousands of people, right, come out to see some ice. And so at like 5 p.m. that night, we're cold and wet and hungry and kind of cranky, and we have to find our cabin. And because there's thousands of people who have traveled to find this ice, accommodations are scarce. So we end up at this cabin. It's like outside of a small town, and it's down a secluded road, and it's up a long and winding personal driveway, and the neighbors are miles away. And so we get there, and it's a really nice cabin. You know, it's got 4 bedrooms, it's really big, it's beautiful. We're drinking and getting to know each other. We're playing games and laughing. It turns into like a dance party that goes till 3 a.m. We're like rocking out in this cabin. Then we go to bed. And I think like the sun is kind of coming up, and it's really quiet in the cabin. And I wake up and I have to pee. I get up and I go to pee, and I'm a little bleary-eyed, you know, and I go to the bathroom, and I come out of the bathroom and I'm like, you know, I think I maybe should get a drink of water. On the wall between the bathroom and the kitchen is a bloody handprint.
Was it just a dream or a more sinister turn of events? To find out, join us Friday morning for the conclusion of The Bloody Handprint, a story from Exfabula in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Well, now you could wait till Friday morning, or we could sneak it in our next hour, part 2 of this special Halloween Wisconsin Life episode. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the rise in school referendums here in Wisconsin and what they mean for the way we fund education in the state. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, meteorologists are making their predictions for the winter months. Our guest tells us what's in store for Wisconsin and gives us an inside look at how these long-term weather forecasts are made. First, a growing number of school districts are going to voters for funding increases in Wisconsin. The process happens through what's called a school referendum, where local voters get to approve or reject new spending for schools. In a recent piece for wiscontext.org, our next guest breaks down what's been happening with school referendums and what's behind their growing popularity. Sarah Kemp is a researcher with the School Enrollment Projections Program at the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Laboratory. You can find that recent piece about school referendums online at wiscontext.org. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Pleasure to be here, Rob.
Let's first of all talk about what a school referendum does. There are a couple different uses, you write. What do they do with them?
There are primarily 2 different types of referendums. One called debt issuing referendums, which are used for capital expenses, and then there's operational referendums that are, as described, helps pay the bills.
So if I want to build a new school, say, I would do that debt one for that capital improvement or renovate my school.
Correct.
And that other one is, okay, we're, for whatever reason, not making ends meet day to day or year to year. That's that second kind.
Right. So it's increasing the revenue limits, the set state revenue limits that are placed on districts. And it can be either a reoccurring or non-reoccurring referendum. So reoccurring would be that it would continue once you've approved it, it's going to stay in that budget. But the non-reoccurring would just be a set time frame.
And that kind is, if you're a property taxpayer, that's the one you'd see on your property tax bill, either as a one-off or ongoing.
The operational, yes.
Okay. And who puts these on the ballot? Who's the decider who says, okay, we're voting this year?
The school district, they're asking for permission from the taxpayers, but they are ultimately the ones that are deciding to do that referendum.
Okay, those are the basics. That's our referendum 101. Now let's get to the heart of your piece. What are we seeing over the last 10 years ago when it comes to the number of school referenda in the state?
So there's three things that stand out for me. The number of referendums have been increasing in overall in the last 10 years. Districts are also choosing to have two or more referendums on the ballot, and that's increasing as well. And then the dollars requested are increasing.
And there's a couple different reasons behind that. And you break it down, and you've done this before. Different kinds of school districts, rural, suburban, town, or urban. And the reasons for those referendums are different from one place to another. I want to start by visiting rural Wisconsin. What's happening there and what's driving it?
So rural Wisconsin is a bit unique compared to other districts in the state in that they're going to more of the operational referendums and requesting actually more dollars in terms of the sheer number. You know, they're not requesting more dollars than an urban or suburban area, but per capita, their numbers are higher in terms of their referendums. And so over the last 10 years, 50% of those referendums that have been on the ballot are rural districts.
Okay. And we have the way it shakes out, we have a lot of rural districts, right? But they each have, of course, fewer students than, say, the four big urban districts.
Correct. So we have many more rural districts. We have over 55% of the districts are rural, but only about 20% of the student population is within those rural districts.
And that's part of the story. And you've been on with us to talk about this before. A lot of those rural districts, we hear again and again, they're seeing declining populations in their community and smaller numbers of students. Can you talk about how that affects their financing?
So their numbers are declining in many districts, and so that means they get less revenue from the state.
Right, because the state says part of the funding is per student at your school, right?
Correct. So it's a three-year average, but they take those numbers and say, okay, this is how many students you have, so this is how much the formula allows you to have based on your enrollment.
And the expenses don't necessarily shrink along with that, right? You can't shrink your school size. You still need the buses to run the same routes. There are a lot of fixed expenses that don't go down even as the number of students go down.
Correct. So when you look at the numbers and you see that both revenue per student and cost per student, those numbers are higher in a rural district for that very reason.
And so is this part of what's driving a lot of these rural districts to go and ask for these operational referendums to help make ends meet?
I believe so. I believe that is what is happening in those districts is to make ends meet. They're more frequently going to referendum.
How much of this is affected by the direct state commitment to schools, and are there solutions from the state level? We've heard about, the scarcity aid that's targeting these rural districts we're talking about.
So what has happened over the last several years is there's been much discussion about the revenue limit and how to fix the funding formula, but there have been small fixes like the sparsity aid, which we call categorical funding that is based specifically for certain types of districts.
We are talking to Sarah Kemp with the School Enrollment Projections Program at the UW Applied Population Laboratory, talking about a piece she has on wiscontext.org, finding a growth in the number of referendums, school funding referendums around the state. There's a good chance you have one in your community on Election Day next Tuesday. All right, that's rural. There's a different story, it seems like, in suburban Wisconsin, where they're asking for different kinds of referendums for different reasons.
Correct. So we have a different story with the suburban districts, and they are more often going to these issuing debt referendums. And they on the flip side of the rural districts are growing, are seeing increases in their student population. And so they're asking taxpayers, voters to allow them to issue debt in order to pay for capital expenses like building schools, renovating schools, to accommodate these increases in students.
Now, what do we know about success rates in these two areas we've been talking about, the rural and the suburban? Are voters more likely to say, yeah, go for it these days?
So we are seeing definitely an increase in the number of passages of these referendums. In 2011, only 55% of these referendums passed. And up to this point in 2018, as of August, 85% of them passed. So it's quite significant when you even just look from 2011 to 2018. So there is a more frequent passage of these.
Now, I know you can't read the mind of every voter in every district for one of these referendums, but are there thoughts as to why? And that's a pretty big jump in referendum approval.
It is. And there are certain economic forces that will affect people's attitudes about voting. And so that could be coming into play, as well as just the economy in general. As we see an improvement in the economy, people may be more willing to accept these referendums.
And we haven't covered the two other areas. And I don't know, I think the rural and suburban were the most striking parts of the story. That leaves the towns kind of in between rural and suburban. And there it seems like, and we've talked to other people from the Applied Population Lab about this, really depends on where that town is.
That is so true, Rob. So the towns are that geographic middle between suburban and rural districts. And so so depending on, again, if they're increasing in population, they're likely to go more to the debt referendum. And if they are declining, they're more likely to go towards the operational referendum. So it depends on where you live.
And then finally, there's the urban districts. And there's just four considered urban, but they have a lot of students in them.
Right. So urban districts have not gone to referendum very much at all in this 10-year window. They are very small in number. And so it's just, I haven't really dived into the urban side of things, what's going on there, if there's just not a need for it. And their budgets are doing fine with the resources they have.
And just digging into some numbers, we've got a bunch of referendums coming up next week. We had a bunch in the spring, right? How many are we seeing around the state if we take them all together in 2018?
So in 2018, so far we've had 74 referendums, and we're going to see another 82 referendums in November on the ballot. So the November ballot, this represents 61 districts of all these regions that we spoke of, the different locales. And it's a total of $1.4 billion that's going to be asked in November.
And that is a substantial number any way you slice it compared to past years?
Correct. It is the highest that it's been, at least in this 10-year window that we're looking at. And the last time we saw this was back in 2016. The number was pretty close to the same number, a little bit smaller, but this is definitely the largest we've seen in recent history.
All right. Well, that's a lot to watch for on Tuesday, in addition to, races for governor and Senate and all that. Thank you, Sarah, so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
That was Sarah Kemp of the UW Applied Population Lab. She was with us to talk about her recent piece for wiscontext.org about the rise in school funding referendums. Coming up, we'll talk about what winter may have in store for Wisconsin and how meteorologists come up with their long-range weather forecasts. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you're planning to vote early in next Tuesday's elections, stay tuned. There's still time. We'll break down everything early voters need to know to cast their ballots. 21st, the Climate Prediction Center recently came out with its winter outlook for the United States. For meteorologists, winter consists of December, January, and February, the calendar months. Generally speaking, meteorologists say they can reliably predict the weather as far as 3 days out or so. So what should we think when we see these seasonal outlooks weeks in advance? Matt Rosenkranz is a meteorologist and seasonal forecaster for the NOAA Climate Prediction Center. That's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, everybody.
Well, tell us what, first of all, we're looking at for this winter in Wisconsin and this region of the country. What do we see in the latest seasonal outlook for winter?
So the latest seasonal outlooks from NOAA's Climate Prediction Center generally favor above normal temperatures. The odds for the above normal temperatures are slightly higher in northern Wisconsin and a little bit slightly lower in southern Wisconsin. It's just a slight tilt towards above normal temperatures. When we move to talk about precipitation, generally the Great Lakes region for this year is favoring slightly below normal precipitation, though it doesn't mean a single snowstorm couldn't be a blockbuster event. But generally, when you average out the entire winter, as you mentioned, December, January, February, when we add up all those numbers, we'll look at it likely to be below normal.
And these seasonal outlooks, they don't say how much warmer or how much colder it might be or how much more dry or wet it might be. This is a numbers and an odds game when it comes when we're comparing it to an average year, right?
These outlooks from the Climate Prediction Center are absolutely based on the probabilities and odds. So kind of like if you were to get a set of loaded dice, we're thinking that the odds, you know, our forecast here is that the dice are going to come up to dry or warm a little bit more often than a really, truly fair pair of dice would.
Now let's start digging into how you figure something like that out a little while out from a season. What kind of factors are you looking for in the climate and weather patterns that start to tell you which way these dice are loaded this year?
So some of the tools that we have statistical tools which look at sea surface temperature patterns across the world, and we'll do advanced pattern matching on those. That's called a constructed analog. We also do things called regressions and correlations, where we will correlate and do statistical relationships between snow cover over Canada, even snow cover in Eurasia. We'll even do sea surface temperature patterns, wind patterns that are out over the Pacific now. We have forecast models, so those are the ones that are run on these supercomputers that take in the past couple of days worth of data and then say if the world played according to these perfect fluid dynamics equations, what would the world look like? And we have the NOAA's climate forecast system. We also have the access to the European system, and we have access to the North American Multi-Model Ensemble, which is a NASA Canadian Meteorological Service, U.S. NOAA's weather models, all of them all put together to come up with a kind of a grand mean of the model. But also we can do a lot of different statistical diagnostics when you have that many models.
Wow. That's a lot of data that gets crunched into this fairly short set of words that forecast what happens in a season.
It's a lot of data. it's on the order for, you know, those that are technologically savvy, terabytes of data that come in and out of this building on a daily basis.
Looking at past predictions like this, so, you know, the 2017, what is winter going to look like in this season and so on back, how well do these tend to do?
So we have our historical skill scores that are on the Climate Prediction Center's website. We put them right out there to get us. And we have positive skill. The temperature forecasts, about 50% of our forecasts, the forecasts that we make forecasts for, the points, come up correct. In a climatological sense, you would only expect 33% of them to come up correct in a long-term forecast if you had no skill. So we're doing 50% at or about there if you take long-term averages. So we add skill, we add value as far as if you take these forecasts and use them for year after year, you would make better economic decisions on those. And that's kind of really a lot of the target is to help people kind of make what we call climate smart decisions on these longer range timescales.
Yeah, do you know what kind of decisions people are making based or informed in part by these longer term forecasts, these seasonal forecasts?
So the seasonal forecasts are used a lot by State Department of Transportation for budget planning on how many pounds of salt, how much overtime they may budget for. A drier season means potentially less snowy events, so maybe there's less snow plows that year. Snow, you may have to have less hours of that. A lot of times they're used for reservoir operations, especially in the western and southern U.S. So they'll be, hey, if there's a wetter forecast coming up, maybe we don't have to be so much on the water restrictions right now. We can not keep increasing those restrictions in dry and drought areas because we're likely to get some relief coming up. So there's a lot of these bigger, larger scale decisions that are made on those.
Talking to Matt Rosenkranz, meteorologist and seasonal forecaster for the NOAA Climate Prediction Center. We're talking about seasonal forecasts. Our seasonal forecast for winter in Wisconsin sounds like a good chance of a warmer than average year and maybe a drier than average year. Matt, let's talk about local variation. This is a three-month period over a wide spatial area, a wide region. Anything can happen when you start to dig in closer, right?
You do end up with a lot of small-scale variability. So while a dry pattern for over the Great Lakes area, and especially Wisconsin, might mean some more northwesterly flow overall, you know, coming from the northwest, which would be a drier pattern, that could lead to locally heavy snowfalls for areas that are just in the right fetch of wind coming down off the lakes. So you may have very small-scale variations that are definitely that kind of confound the overall picture.
That's a local scale. Now, looking at a wider lens, we've got this overall concern about climate change and warmer temperatures. Another guest actually had used the loaded dice analogy about that, too, when it comes to the weather over the future. Does that start to play into your seasonal forecasting?
Yes, we do take into account what we call the trend. So we look at what the temperatures have done over the past 5, 10, 15, 20, and 30 years, and then we can use that as one of our predictor methods, absolutely.
Looking at shorter-term weather forecasts and when they turn from really very likely accurate to too far out to really predict what's going to happen in a particular place at a particular time, how hard is it, once we get past, say, a three-day threshold, to really predict the weather in a local area?
Well, right now, the National Weather Service has quite specific forecasts out to about day 6. So you can really get some pretty good accuracy and specificity out through day 6. We're doing some research and development on how do we push that timeline and border out until days 8, day 9, day 10. We have some really smart people working on that, and we're going to try and build what we call hybrid tools that take in those computer models I talked about before, do some statistics on that computer modeling, and see if we can get some more accurate forecasts to extend that time frame where we can give everyone much more specific information further out in time.
Is there a threshold beyond which we could say, okay, weather is such a complicated system and there's so many variables interacting that, okay, at some point you just can't predict any further out with a forecast? Is there a limit as to how far out we can predict the daily weather accurately?
There's theoretical limits that people, the research was done in the 50s and 60s, but for doing this specific type of forecast, the high temperature will be a certain value. That tends to fall off in about the about 2 weeks, and then after that, you really should be giving odds and probabilities and ranges of things. NOAA's Climate Prediction Center actually starts doing some of that probabilistic work at starting at week 2 in that time frame. So we have a really good transition from the precipitation and temperature specific amounts to a question of more that loaded dice. How loaded are they this time?
And this is the last day of October. We're talking about the seasonal forecast for December, January, February. Such a forecast exists, but do you revise it and update it through November as we close in on actual meteorological winter?
Yes, the Climate Prediction Center releases our seasonal outlooks on the third Thursday of every month. So in November, on November 15th at 8:30 in the morning East Coast time, Eastern time, we will be updating and giving one final outlook for the December, January, February timeframe.
And do you and your fellow meteorologists have any kind of office pool for how accurate the forecasts are?
No, we're actually doing we forecast all as a team. So we do on individual snowstorms. We'll put a, for the D.C. area, because that's where we are living and working, we'll have a snow pool on the wall. But for the overall forecast for the winter, we all do it as a team. So it's one. It's, we either all live or we all go down with the ship.
There is no I in weather team. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Very welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Matt Rosenkranz, meteorologist and seasonal forecaster for the NOAA Climate Prediction Center. We talked with him about the agency's winter forecast for Wisconsin. Odds are warmer than average and drier than average, it sounds like, and how these long-range weather forecasts are put together. By the way, meteorological winter is coming. It starts a month from tomorrow. Well, what are you hoping for in a Wisconsin winter this year? Do you like that idea of warmer and drier than usual? Or do you need some snow for the fun stuff you like to do? Let us know. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. The folks at 538.com are best known for their data-driven analysis of politics and sports. This Halloween, they're out with a new power ranking of Halloween candy. Quickly, the methodology, it's not super scientific. They had thousands of people online selecting candies in head-to-head matchups. Jay Carlisle-Larson has opinions. Hey, JC.
Oh, yeah, I have strong opinions.
So Reese's dominates. The one and two spot are Reese's varieties, two more in the top 10. One of your favorites, candy corn. Now, where did that fall to? Way down on the list.
It wasn't on the list at all?
It was in the 60s,
oh, okay.
67.
So, you know, I do like candy corn. I'm one of those in the minority that will admit that they like candy corn too. Dave is also
Dave
saying
Pochester,
he likes,
yep, he likes
candy
it too.
Corn. But I was surprised at just how many peanut plus chocolate varieties made it into like the top 20.
Yeah, they did a breakdown. And if chocolate seems to be the best thing that propels candies to victory, peanut butter and nuts are up there too. Nougat does pretty well as well.
Sure. Yeah.
You're anti-nougat, right?
No.
No, you're okay with nougat?
I'm pretty much I like candy. As an adult, I'm still on board with it.
All right, bottom of the list, number 86. Now, this is behind, by the way, they threw in one quarter and one dime. Like, would you rather take the cash value versus the candy at a Halloween pickup? Anyway,
ooh,
at the bottom of the list, Good and Plenty. The
you
movie
know,
theater favorite from years back.
You know what? I actually
good
do like
Good
and Plenty.
Plenty.
Those are the, that's what tastes like black licorice, right?
Yeah.
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 I'm on board.
I would elevate it a lot on this list. I think that's underrated. There's way worse candy out there. JC, happy candy corn eating.
I love it.
You can have mine.
Okay.
This is Central Time.